Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. You are listening to Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. This is Monday night, the 25th of August, 2014. And we appreciate you listening to our call this evening. So we really are thankful that you're here, that you've decided to tune in tonight and possibly to join in our conversation. Before we get started and I introduce our guests tonight, I want to give you our guest call-in number. Our call-in number is 646-716-9397. That's 646-716-9397. And as many of you know who have been listening to our show for some time, I'm Reverend Jennifer Hope Kotler. I'm a spiritual life and leadership coach in private practice. I live in Illinois, and I am really happy to be hosting the show tonight with my colleague Rebecca Stevens.
Hello!
New York, coming to you from New York, and she is a first-year student at Union Theological Seminary and the Children's Music Director at the First Presbyterian Church in the city of New York. And you'll be listening to hear more from her later on as to who she is and what she brings to this particular conversation. Tonight, we want to have a conversation about race and racism, given the fact of all that has gone on in Ferguson, Missouri over the last few weeks. Today was the funeral of Michael Brown in Ferguson or outside of St. Louis. It was televised. I had an opportunity to watch some of that today. And tonight, I feel really honored and privileged to have as our guests, first, Reverend April Johnson, who is the Minister of Reconciliation for the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. April's job is basically to address racism both within the church and beyond its bounds on behalf of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, and I'll let her go into more about that in just a minute. And our other guest is Minister Thomas Bowen, who is the Minister for Fellowship, Social Justice, and Community Outreach at the Shiloh Baptist Church in the city of Washington, D.C., and I'm very thankful to call them both my friends and to have them both with us on the show tonight. So Let's start just the conversation. We were talking a little bit before we came on the air tonight about how this is race can be a very difficult conversation, particularly for majority race, European culture, white folks to have, because it's not something that we are particularly comfortable having conversations about. Race is not something that we often have conversations about until it's intentional conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And But I also know from the other side of the fence that when race is a very lived experience of your everyday life, it's just embedded in almost a lot of things or all things that we talk about. So just want to open that up, and maybe you could start, Rebecca, by talking a little bit about your particular social location, and then we'll just kind of open it up. April, you can share more about who you are, and Thomas as well. So
awesome.
There you go.
Yeah, and thank everybody for listening. I also want to point out that these folks came on, Thomas and April came on sort of last minute, and I really appreciate that. Jen and I talked earlier last week and just felt like this was a critical conversation to have right now, and so we made some changes to the programming. And you guys were super gracious to come on at the last minute and talk about what I consider to be a pretty difficult issue. I'm a middle-class white girl from the South. I was raised, in fact, not to talk about race. It was something that we were not supposed to bring up. And that was considered, when I was growing up and in the small town that I grew up in, that was considered the sort of liberal way to function. Race is not an issue for, race was not supposed to be an issue. I was, I guess that's where I'm coming from. I think that conversations about race are important, but I'm always hyper aware of my whiteness, and am constantly tweaking what I can bring to the table. And I do believe that I have a voice in the conversation, but I'm very, very mindful to be a listener before I am a speaker. That's where I'm coming from. And again, thank you, Thomas and April, for being a part of this conversation, for educating us, we as colleagues in ministry, for having this conversation in a faith setting. And I'll pass it to April, and April, speak your heart.
Well, great. Well, at first I want to say thank you so much to you, Jennifer, and to you, Rebecca, for your response to the situation, and to use this medium as an opportunity to have the conversation that must be had. And I'm so glad that we are in a time where we have so many more resources to be able to demonstrate the way in which we all have been misshaped by this sin called racism. We all have been used by it, and for many of us, we have been in denial about the way in which racism shows up in all of our lives. And I thought Jennifer was particularly profound when she talked about knowing about race from both perspectives, mm-hmm. as a white woman, but also knowing that people that work up in skin that has hue are acutely aware that race is a part of their everyday life. Wake mm-hmm. up knowing that they are brown and black, and maybe not even entitled to all of the resources of what God has given us to be good stewards of. I serve as Minister of Reconciliation, which is Executive Director of our Reconciliation Racial Justice Ministry for the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. My responsibility is to resource our congregations for mission, particularly around racial justice, but that also invites them into the conversation to help us contextualize how racial justice appears in a church that is primarily white and rural. I also have the responsibility of informing the church on how racism shows up in ways that are not about personal prejudice, but that are really about the way racism is structural and systemic. And I think, Rebecca, you were saying part of the reason why you were taught not to talk about race is because we only talk about race from the things that we can see. And when we talk about systemic and structural racism, it's very difficult to see because it's intentional that we don't see that our whole being, our existence as a nation comes from a structure that was never meant to include non-white males. And we know that intellectually, but we don't live that. And we this opportunity, unfortunately, gives us a chance to actually see it. It's bringing what has been under the surface up to the surface. And these conversations will really help us be able to contextualize structural and systemic racism. So I am grateful to be a part of a conversation that also helps people of color be able to be gentle about the fact that white people really don't know how they benefit from the structures that are indeed racist. We assume, because we're so acutely aware of how we are denied access, that everyone else knows the same thing. But I'm also just really happy to be able to have this conversation with the unfortunate loss of yet another black man's life So yeah. I'm grateful for the sustained protests in Ferguson, and I'm also sad for the loss for the Brown family and the Ferguson community, and mm-hmm. also sad for the police officer and his family who are actually losing part of their lives in this process.
Yeah.
So I'll stop there and I'll turn it over to you all.
We'll pass to Thomas. Thomas, what can you tell us about yourself, and what do you bring to the conversation?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to participate in the conversation. Thanks to my good friend, Reverend Jen. I grew up in a small town outside of Cleveland, about 25 miles west of Cleveland, a town called Elyria. And race is something I had to encounter from birth and from memory. Race is a difficult conversation, but it is a necessary conversation. John Holt Franklin, who was the chair of the Commission on Race that was convened by President Bill Clinton at the conclusion of their activities, made this profound statement that those of us who think that we have advanced and have escaped racism in our society have escaped reality. I put that statement mm-hmm. aside the sign that I saw a protester carry. A young lady had a sign hoisted in the air in Ferguson that simply stated, "I can't believe that we still have to fight this shit."
Right.
Racism is not going anywhere until we right. really sit down and decide to do something about it. This is a teaching moment. This is a preaching moment, but it's also mm-hmm. a time of action. Everything in my small town of Elyria was about race. I shudder to think that I love skiing, and we had ski clubs in Elyria. We had ski clubs in junior high. We had ski clubs in high school. But I did not begin skiing until my adult life when I came to Washington, D.C., and we decided to take our young people on an annual ski trip. And when I went skiing for the first time and found out that I loved it, I had to go back to growing up in Elyria, Ohio, in those ski clubs, and to think that I did not participate because that was what the white kids did. It robbed me of so many experiences. I did not play tennis, even though the tennis coach begged me to play, that he would teach me the game, that the football coach had told him that I had great hands. But I, in my mind, in my experience of race, thought that what black kids did in the spring was run track, so I did not play tennis. Race is a part of our makeup, is a part of our experiences. We know that, as my mentor Mary Wright Ullman would say, that children have unequal childhoods here in America. But I'm hoping, and that's a part of my problem, I'm filled with hope. No matter what, I'm hoping that finally we will begin to recognize, move beyond the dialogue into action. My ministry at Shiloh Baptist Church, which is 151 years old, which was founded by 21 former slaves as they journeyed from Fredericksburg, Virginia, to the federal city of Washington, D.C., that the social justice ministry that I helped to create at Shiloh Baptist Church is a call and response ministry. We engage in a dialogue out there in the public square, but then with the call there comes a response. And now is the time for the church to respond. I was telling folks just last week that if you go to a church and on that Sunday, on last Sunday, there was no mention of Ferguson, Missouri, you ought to leave that church. If you go to a church and every Sunday you are not tried, you are not made to be uncomfortable, that you're just there, relax, and you leave the same way that you come, and you need to change and to leave that church. And the church has a responsibility. We have a responsibility in light of what we're faced with, the not just historical black church, but the church universal, to respond to what has taken place in our country, because lives, black lives, all lives, ought to be valued. And I take serious the conversation recorded in Matthew when a lawyer approached Jesus saying, "What's the greatest commandment?" And he said, "To love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, thy mind, and thy soul." But then he stopped and pulled him by the collar back to him. "But the second is like unto it, to love your neighbor as yourself." Now's the time for the church to take up those words, to heed that call, treat each and every one as we would like ourselves to be treated.
That's great. Wow, that's April and Thomas both. That's all very, very powerful. I guess I'm kind of like in a place where I do some work with the LGBTQ community, and as you in that work, we hear the term ally quite a bit, and I guess I would want to know what an ally of a minority community would do. How can a middle-class white girl from the South be an ally and advocate appropriately for racial justice? Anybody?
Well, it's interesting that, like you say, you do work with the LGBT community. And let's be clear, the Black Church has not been a friend of the LGBT community, and we've been a walking contradiction. I, who consider myself to be a true progressive, know that one of the things that I can do when it comes to LGBT community and rights is that when I'm in spheres, when I'm around my friends and they are engaged in homophobic behavior and attitudes and jokes that I don't engage in, I call them on that. And I think that that's what, let me loosely say, the white church can do right now, is to call out the racism that exists and that is surrounding us, putting its clothes on around this issue. People are being made aware of the defense fund for the police officer in this case, and most of the comments around that are rooted and clothed in racism. So I think that those in our community or those who want to be friends on this issue, they have the ability and they must call racism when they see it.
Yeah, I would agree, Thomas. That's an important point to bring up, that And oftentimes I've done this. I've asked people to imagine if, in particularly in this case, what if the races were reversed? What if it had been a Black police officer that had killed an unarmed white youth who had just graduated from high school and was headed to college in the fall? What would be the outcry? And what, how does that change things and are thinking about it? So if we pretend that race doesn't impact or doesn't color, if you will, our perspectives, try changing that around a bit so that sort of brings to light the level of outrage or the level of pain that a particular community would feel if they, in fact, were on the receiving end of the violence.
Yes. Also, April, I wanted to ask about, did I hear somebody cut out? Are we all still here?
I'm here.
I'm still here.
April's still here. Jen, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, great. Jen, still there? Jen. Okay, so it sounds like we lost Jen. That's okay. She'll come back, I believe. But we still have Thomas and April, so I'm going to continue the conversation. April, I wanted to ask you in particular, I this is something I'm always aware of. I always go back to, and forgive me because I don't remember who told me this, but I was a child, and I was told that, there are many people, many groups in the world who are oppressed, and in our country there are many groups that are oppressed, but the most oppressed group of people in this country are African-American women. And, you know, again, obviously something I can't speak to firsthand. And we, in this conversation about Ferguson and certainly about Staten Island, we're talking about the African-American male demographic. But I do, as a female, feel a particular pull to talk about race, but also sexism and how that is pulled into this conversation. Is that something that you care to speak to?
Sure. I hope this can also address the question about being the ally as well, because I want to pick up on what Jennifer was saying.
Yeah.
So part of the reality of isms is that someone benefits from being heterosexist, and someone benefits from being racist, and someone benefits from being sexist. And so what happens for me, my own position is, what happens for me is the African-American female is subject to sexism and racism, but racism, all of those isms are fundamentally a power play. And often the African-American female is used to weaken the African-American male. I'm just going to be
right.
This comes out of slavery, when we were torn apart from our husbands, our sons, and reality is we not have the conversation. We can see how this type of trauma persists in the African American. Now, as it for denomination, it is unquestionable that the African American woman is the most oppressed in the institution called the church, because we are the last to get the premier calls. So you're there in New York. Jennifer is not going to be called to be, you're probably not going to like to be called to one of our large churches in New York. Because the assigning judicatory is in it of itself sexist. The churches not a woman, and so they're not going to want to call an African-American woman. And so the reality is all of these isms, they kind of play into each other. And what happens is because it is fundamentally a sin, evil persists so that the isms against each other. So we have this thing called the oppression of women. I've heard that before. So one of the things that keeps coming up during this Ferguson conversation is, why aren't we talking about immigration and Hispanics? We're talking about this situation. And there is something very different that is happening in the African-American community between African-Americans and whites, and we won't have that conversation, and between immigrant communities.
Yes.
And so, you know, women in general are oppressed.
Yeah.
And African-American women are oppressed in some institutions, but they're also used to further oppress the African-American male, which is different than what happened with sexism in communities.
That's really fascinating. I had never heard it articulated like that, and that's a really, really great way to say it. I want to confirm, Jen, are you back on with us?
I am. And
okay.
Thomas, I'm wondering what your perspective is on the comment that April just made.
Yeah, I think that unfortunately we always get to the point of is there a big sin or a little sin? Is there a big ism or a small ism? And what I keep thinking about that is whenever you have racism in a car, the other isms are there as well. They're friends with one another, they ride together. So whenever racism is present, sexism is going to be either in the front seat or the back seat or following the car. And that seems to be how we operate.
Right, right.
April,
yeah,
and that's what I mean about how sin uses us all, you know. And the secular world probably doesn't understand sin in the way that I would, as a person who trained in ministry or considers myself a pastor. But the reality is this kind of evil. Evil, I just told someone tonight, I believe that evil is not predictable. So you have to really be prepared for however it's going to show up. And so, you know, for no other reason to be a person of faith. Be a person of faith because whoever you are, evil is going to visit you. And so you can't recognize the way in which sexism and racism function together. You know, I think I heard him say they ride out together. I love, you know, analogy. And they do all the isms, ride out together. And then when it hits the fan, then they are against each other. Well, you did it first. No. The reality is someone benefits from the ways in which we use our power. Do we use our power for good or do we use our power to oppress others? And oftentimes the whole basis of the ism is that power is used so that someone can benefit. And what happens is we have all, this is what implicit bias really comes down to, we have all been shaped in this power structure that says, well, this is my piece of the pie. And if I keep from getting to this piece of the pie, then I can always be sure that you know, myself and my identity is always secure, which is a lie.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's totally against, you know, the Mbutu principle. I mean, it's just really a lie. But we've all been sold this lie. So it's not white folks had a lie bigger than us. We all have been sold this lie. And that's why the isms all work together and sometimes function against each other.
Right. That's good. Thanks, April. I just want to remind folks of our call-in number, and we do have a guest waiting to chime in. So our guest call-in number for any of you who are interested in joining our conversation is 646-716-9397, 646-716-9397. You're listening to Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca with our guest hosts tonight, April Johnson and Thomas Bowen. So caller, would you introduce yourself and ask your question or make your comment.
Yes, this is Kathy calling from Durham, North Carolina.
Hey, Kathy.
Hey, Rebecca. First of all, I want to thank you so much for the dialogue and hope that it will be an ongoing dialogue, not just confined to an hour or two. Mm-hmm. We need to have this ongoing. Secondly, I am also filled with hope, albeit tempered with the reality of living in a racially charged atmosphere in Durham, North Carolina. I would say, I heard someone say, if Ferguson was not mentioned, leave your church. I would say, stay at your church and be a change. Now, I can say that because thankfully Ferguson was front and center at my church and will continue to be. It was mentioned from the pulpit, and I go to a church that is racially diverse. I think it's also good to be more of a listener. I heard one of you say that. But we also need to speak up and out, even when it's uncomfortable. Recently had an opportunity with two young North Carolina Central students who were visiting an apartment complex where they were called thugs and criminals. One of them is a brown version of my skinny, geeky, white grandson. And yet, because of his skin color, he was called a thug and a criminal. The other one is a dreadlocked drummer, but he's still not a thug or a criminal. I want to say that the woman who made these slanderous remarks was evicted from her apartment. She was given 30 days to leave. So there are changes out there. There are people who care and carry on. I'm listening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Oh, one more question. We all as Christians need to say, who are our neighbors? Our neighbors extend far beyond the borders of a physical neighborhood. I'll leave on that. Thank you.
Amen. Thank you.
We love Kathy. Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Yeah, it was.
Do you know who that is?
I do.
That's Jason Herod's mom.
Yeah. And really appreciate her calling in tonight and and raising the question. I was, you know, I'm struck by, and I have continued to be struck by during this entire conversation. First of all, because of the move that we were involved with, and we didn't have television or internet service here at the house for the first 10 years that we were here in Illinois, the information that I was getting on my news feed on Facebook and the conversations, and I wasn't able to see the news broadcast and to see images of what was going on. My girlfriend Heather Wilson has been in Ferguson for the last week or so, has been on the ground, she's a photojournalist, and she's been taking pictures. I had talked to her about the possibility of joining us tonight. She, I know, is just really distressed at what she has seen on the ground as far as the response from the police department. And I'm really distressed by the level of militarization that we are seeing that seems to be increasing over time. You know, these images of dogs and tear gas, you know, put me in Birmingham. And I'm just wondering what, you know, what is it going to take for the outcry to really look at beyond the black white issues, which we do have to talk about, because I live in a bubble now. I'm in white suburbia, and nobody around here has to talk about any of this because it's not a part of their lived experience, and it's not, you know, the chances of the police showing up in riots in the community are very slim. But, you know, I'm only 30 miles from the city limits of Chicago, and a city that I love, a city that I lived in for 10 years, and I'm completely distressed by the level of violence that's happening there. Antonio Smith, the name that you probably haven't heard, a 9-year-old who was shot 6 times only a block or two from his home. He was found in a back. They were talking about how he had, you know, a 9-year-old was executed. Just tragic levels of violence, and the violence in other parts of our society are spilling over and are, I think, in many ways increasing the violence and the militarization within the police force, particularly police forces that are in communities of color, that are in black and brown communities. So I'm wondering if to get your reactions on that, and to see if, as we think about talking through, we're already into the second half hour of our show tonight, and the time goes so incredibly fast. But, you know, thinking through too, what is a way forward? How can we move forward and use this as a teaching moment, as a conversation moment, as a way of shifting individuals' perceptions about what are the issues that really are tangible and at hand.
And I think I was speaking to one of our laypersons in the St. Louis area who happens to be a president of one of our ministry divisions, and it's actually one of our CARE. It's the National Benevolent Association. And Mark was saying that, I've been to training. I've been over to Ferguson, and I get it intellectually, but what I don't get is I don't know what my next step is.
Right.
And I think part of that is what you were saying, Rebecca. Is like, you know, in terms of, you know, how to be an ally. And I question now. You say, oh, instruction. I question now of instruction. I really think it's more what we were speaking about earlier. It's more toward action. What has to happen? That we have to go to the next step. And some of that means we have to be in intentional dialogue, but we have to be in intentional relationship. And a relationship is painful.
Yes.
And we have done everything we can to avoid the pain of what the next step is. Because what typically happens when people move from the intellectual experience to allowing the Holy Spirit to actually let them have a shared experience with someone who is other than themselves, is there's a kind of vulnerability that we have resisted, which is part of what we see in this militarization of these small police forces and these predominantly brown and black communities, is that this is how we're never vulnerable. You know, what police force needs that kind of equipment for a community of that size? And the reality is we use whatever we can to obstruct our reality that we are vulnerable and we belong to each other. And so the lie that we've all been sold is that we're self-sustaining, we don't need anybody else, but we need each other. And the only way that a white person is going to go to the next step or a black or brown person is going to go to the next step is to be vulnerable, to not just sustain the conversation, but actually confront our own complicity in advancing racism.
I think that a necessary reading along with the Old Testament and New Testament would be Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration, The Age of Colorblindness, which she gives us a history of how the militarization of the police force has taken place. There are many folk who were questioning the response of our president, Barack Obama, to what has gone on. But I was encouraged by something that he did, which is something that Michelle Alexander lays out in her book, and that is that he called for a review of how these military weapons are making their way to the police departments. Well, he should know how they made their way, but to the extent that he's calling it for a review and this is entering into our public discussion, it is necessary. And we had a panel discussion at Shiloh on Saturday, Know Your Rights. It was in partnership with the National Bar Association that approached us. And one of the panelists, who happened to be white, from the University of West Virginia Law School, who's also a former police officer, he said that you cannot give police departments military weapons and train them in military-style combat and then expect them to go and do community policing. Right. It's a shame that also we have national standards for teachers but no national standards for police officers, that you can be involved in an incident and then stay on that job, be on administrative duty for 30 days and be back on the street. You cannot be accused of inappropriate behavior with a child as a teacher and think you're going to keep your job or think that may not follow you. But the same is not the case for the police. Communities of color are over-policed, and then you add to this the weapon that we are giving our police officers, so something that just occurred was bound to happen. It's a textbook example of what not to do when you have situations involving communities. The Ferguson Police Department gave us a textbook definition of what not to do. But ultimately, we're going to have to look at police reform. That's going to be something that we're going to have to look deep. There are some things that we can do, and police reform is one of those things.
Yeah. No, it's really rather amazing that even with the eyes of the world looking at Ferguson, that the police felt that it was appropriate to escalate the situation with the community, that they felt it was appropriate to tear gas crowds that were not violent, that it was only after the police provocation that the second round of looting happened, because there was violence against the protesters. And there is a story that needs to be told that hasn't been told well, I think, by the mainstream press. And Thomas, I'm glad you brought up the New Jim Crow. Compelling book, and I think a real entry point for, could be a strong entry point for white folks who really do want to sort of understand structural racism from the ground up and really see it for what it is.
Yep. I think you for bringing up resources like that. I think that's a really important part of this issue, is educating ourselves. I think April said, we can understand it on an intellectual level. And I think there's some people that are not even to that place yet. I think we have to get to the intellectual level first, and then, to be able to come to a community level. And I think that that's super important. Jen mentioned this earlier, those of you who know, I live in New York City, and it's a place that is often mistaken for progressive, I guess, politics. A tragedy. It was ruled by the coroner homicide by chokehold on Staten Island and this summer. And I was at the rally on Saturday in support of Eric Garner's family, and was accompanied by, or was led by, Only Love Austin. She's the executive director of Faith in New York. And she was telling us about gentrification in the city. And I live in a neighborhood that I'm of the opinion is being gentrified pretty aggressively. And she said what happened, one of the first steps to gentrification is that even though there'll be no one on the streets, the neighborhood will be covered in police officers, which is exactly what's happening in my neighborhood. I don't consider it a dangerous neighborhood, but I can be out in the middle of the day, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and there are police officers all over the place. And it's a way of intimidating people. And I think that was hearing that was a real it was sobering to hear that, because it's a level of racism that, again, that I don't think about. And living in my free and progressive New York City, I don't want to believe that those things happen here. But what's important, I think, too, is to say that having a police force is not a bad thing, and that police officers are not, necessarily the enemy. Although there are bad police officers and there are good police officers, and I think that's part of the community that we can talk about building and being a part of, that police officers are a part of our community and should not be considered necessarily the enemy, but should also be held responsible for their actions, just like the of us are.
Mm-hmm. We had a meeting just last week. It just happened to fall. We scheduled a meeting with the Indianapolis police chief. It just happened to fall the 3 days after the Ferguson incident, or the murder of Michael Brown. Mm-hmm. And
I asked the last question that I asked the police officer, I mean the police chief, was, you know, what prevents Indianapolis from becoming the next Ferguson? And, mm-hmm. of course, his pat answer initially was, well, we do community policing. But what he said that was really inspiring to me was really helpful. He said, the community policing isn't just a philosophy, it's an action. And he said, you know, I, as the police chief, I don't travel with an entourage. He said, you know, I go to funerals, and when I would go to funerals, when I first got here, no one acknowledged me. They didn't, they were threatened by my presence. And he said, now, because I have a presence in the community in times that are not tragic, and I have a relationship with people in the community, but I also have a relationship with the faith community. And I require of the faith community, if they call themselves in partnership with me, to be on the street, to know their neighbors, to be, if you want to be that persistent or, exotic faith person that's on the corner with your Bible, that also prevents violence. And I was shocked when he said that. He says, no, if you're always there, no one's going to come mess with the elderly lady that is standing out there on the corner every day making sure
right.
their kids get to school. Nobody's going to mess with them. Right. Or they're going to come across the street and ask, why are you here every day? You know,
yes.
And it sounds very, very utopian, but it's a reality, at least here in Indianapolis. But it's the reality that I grew up in. You know, I grew up in a family with one male child, and my father died when we were all very young. He was very young, and my brother would ride my father's motorcycle, and the police would stop him and say, you cannot ever get caught speeding on this motorcycle because they knew my parents. Do you know what I mean? They didn't take him in and beat him up. You know, and say, hey, you're speeding. But they knew him. But also our neighbors knew each other, and they knew him. Say, hey, you're speeding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to have to come down and get you in the police station. And so there's some things that the faith community can do, and some of that is what we're doing right now in Ferguson. We are there. We're those of us who are not located in Ferguson or not pastors in the churches there. We have the faith community there. We have the organizing, the interfaith community there. And we just have to make sure that our presence is known in whatever community that we have. And it's going to require us to come out of our comfort zone. The church is very comfortable, which is why the church is becoming irrelevant. We've got to get out of our comfort zone, and we've got to do some community policing with the police. Yes.
Thomas, what has been your experience working with the police in D.C.? Or not?
Thomas, do we have you with us? We've lost Thomas.
Hello.
I'm sorry.
I had it on mute. I'm sorry. Fortunately, we've had a few great police chiefs here in Washington, D.C. currently. Chief Lanier is just outstanding. And as hard as I am on the police, it's hard for me to see what happened in Ferguson occurring here. And I say that from the standpoint that it's likely that it could happen that a police officer could shoot an unarmed youth, but the response of the police chief, I think, would be totally different here in D.C. I agree that we have to partner with police departments. We have to, I think, bring the police into the church to have them meet with young people in the church and outside of the church, because we're finding out that there are many young people who do not see the police as their friend.
Right.
And this has wide consequences for our neighborhoods, because if you don't see the police as your friend, who are you going to call here in time
right.
of trouble and need?
Mm.
And there are
mm-hmm.
oftentimes, particularly in communities of color, where there are people who will not call the police for fear what will happen with those young people, if you will, when the police do come. But I think that the church can encourage dialogue. At Shiloh, we actually have police officers. We have a former D.C. commander who I know gets it right, and I've thought, and we are, when our children and youth church convene on the first Sunday in September, are going to ask the police officer to come and to talk with our young people. So that's one of those tangible things that the church can and must do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we are now in basically our last 10 minutes. I want to give folks who are listening live a chance to call in. You're listening to Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. We've been having, I think, a wonderful conversation about race and racism, about being an ally, about having conversations, and we'd like to have one with you. The call-in number is 646-716-9397. That's 646-716-9397. Now, one thing that I was thinking about, April, is in the essence of full disclosure, I sit on the Reconciliation Ministry for the Christian Church Disciples, so I'm on April's commission, and we often do have conversations. And one of the models that we've often used is to caucus as white folks and as people of color to have particular conversations, because it is important for white folks to talk with other white folks about racism. And I think that's one of the things, particularly in the segregation that we see within our communities. And again, our, you know, Sunday morning at 11 a.m. still continues to be one of the most segregated hours of the week, to have those conversations in white churches between white folks. Shortly after the Trayvon Martin verdict, what was it, last summer, we had a conversation in the church where my husband, Gavin, was pastoring in Westchester County in New York, and they, knowing that I had this relationship with the Reconciliation Ministry and the Disciples of Christ, asked if I would facilitate the conversation. And it was really interesting to hear questions about, you know, why are we, it's almost entirely, but not entirely, white congregation. Why is it that we have a white person facilitating the conversation? And my response was that I think it's important that white folks be talking with other white folks about race and not simply relying on the person of color to tell their story, which is important. Those bearing witness is so important, but it's also important to be in spaces where people feel safe even sort of admitting or not even possibly knowingly admitting a particular prejudice or a particular understanding. So I'm wondering what you all think about that, and as a way for us to move forward and keep the conversation going.
Well, you know that I'm obviously an advocate of caucusing because it's, you know, it's what I do. But I also think that we don't understand each other's lived experience. You know, I listen to even black folks talk about the looting, and I'm disheartened because I'm not a proponent of looting, but I'm also in my spirit acutely aware of the despair in the African-American community. And so the rage that comes out of that despair may cause you to break a window and go in and take a fountain of milk. Who knows? It has an expression. I don't know that a white person can hear that from me. So it may be that a white person may have to identify with the kind of despair that happens in their community or in their individual family. You know, people of color tend to see themselves as a collective, and white people tend to see themselves as an individual until they have the conversation and see how they are connected either by family or by community. But we don't have that conversation enough. And so I do think that there are times when we're valid within our group. And we have and we're the only person that can be valid in that. And it also takes away the stereotype that the only people that have a problem with race are the people who are oppressed by race.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Huh. That's profound. What about you, Thomas? What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I agree. It's just so necessary. We need outrage, and we need sustained outrage. We cannot afford to only speak out on issues when we have situations like a Ferguson takes a situation like that to talk about race, when it takes a Sandy Hook to talk about guns and violence. We need outrage. We need sustained outrage. We need everyone to be outraged. And I think when it comes to the topic and the conversation about race, yes, it cannot be seen just as a black issue. One of the things that came to mind early in our conversation this evening was the courtroom scene from A Time to Kill with Matthew McConaughey and Samuel L. Jackson. And when he was giving his closing argument, and he asked the jury and by extension those in the courtroom to imagine, all right, the little girl being white. And that's when you had this silence. It's a turning of the table. We need outrage, and the church is in a unique position to help us with this outrage because they can change the conversation, so to speak, to not just be about a black life, which is important, about the sanctity of life. Isn't it interesting? We're talking about life here. We're a pro-lifers. A life was taken. They're silent, and we know why. And we must admit that for the most part, pro-lifers, the conservative arm of our faith, control the conversation. A life was taken, but we become silent. Pro-life before the death penalty. Pro-life, but not for a good quality life. So you're not for a livable wage. Pro-life. But you want to cut on welfare benefits. Pro-life, but you want everyone to be able to carry a gun. We have to call people out on this. And the folk who do not agree with said thinking and interpretations of the scripture and view of the life of Jesus, we are the ones who must raise our voices, black and white.
Thank you so much for saying that about, I love using that term, pro-life. I know we're getting to the end of our broadcast, and before we get to the end, Jen has some program notes to let our listeners know before we go, because we have a different schedule in September. But I just want to take a moment to and if you're listening, you can pray or you can have your have a moment of silence or meditate on. I just want to lift up the mothers in this world who have lost their children to violence. That's something that has struck me so much in all of this is seeing the moms who have lost their children to gun violence or to police brutality. So I just feel compelled to say, that obviously, we grieve, but a mother's loss of a child, I think, is an egregious sin. So I just want to put that out there and hope that that will be on people's hearts and minds. And then I'll pass to Jen to wrap us up.
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca. And I just want to say thank you, April and Thomas, for joining us tonight, for bringing your unique perspectives and for helping us just process that as the church, as people who are, as you so eloquently said, Thomas, who are pro-life, need to really assess what does that mean, and is that about, holding the sanctity of life for all people. And so we certainly, and we lift up the family of Michael Brown and the families of so many people who have been taken from us way too soon, for all the mothers who have lost children and have felt the need to, have had to bury those children. And we pray for them tonight. Mm-hmm. And I just want to thank all of our listeners. If you are interested in connecting with us, please find us on Facebook, like us on Facebook. We're over 100 likes on Facebook.
Yay!
And we're thankful for that. So find us at Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. And in September, our program, Doug Padgett, who's the founder of Solomon's Porch and the founding director of Convergence, which is a new progressive Christian movement, is going to join us in September on either the 15th or the 29th. So in September, we're going to be on the 3rd and 5th Monday of the month instead of the 2nd and 4th as we are usually. At 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Central, we look forward to your continued listening and engagement with us. And I'm Reverend Jennifer Hope Kotler, and this is...
I'm Rebecca Stevens.
Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night.